92.
I am Willie. I am Willie. I am even yet. Am not Willie. Not Willie, but somehow less. More. All is allowed now. All is allowed me now. All is allowed light, light, light me now. Getting up out of bed and going down to the party. Allowed. Candy bees. Allowed. Chunks of cake. Allowed. Punch, even rum punch. Allowed. Let that band play louder. Swinging from the chandelier. Allowed. Floating up to ceiling. Allowed. Going to window to have a look out. Allowed. 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 Flying out window. Allowed. Allowed. The entire laughing party of guests happily joining behind me, urging me to please, yes, fly away, saying, oh, he feels much better now, he does not seem sick at all. Whatever that former fellow, Willie, had, must now be given back, is given back gladly, as it never was mine, never his, and therefore is not being taken away, not at all. As I, who was of Willie, but is no longer merely of Willie, return to such beauty.
93. There in his seat, Mr. Lincoln startled.
Like a schoolboy jolting suddenly awake in class.
Looked around.
Momentarily unsure, it seemed, of where he was.
Then got to his feet and made for the door.
The lad's departure having set him free.
So quickly did he move that he passed through us before we could step aside.
And again, briefly, we knew him.
94.
His boy was gone. His boy was no more.
His boy was nowhere. His boy was everywhere.
There was nothing here for him now.
His boy was no more here than any place else, that is. There was nothing special anymore about this place.
His continued presence here was wrong, was wallowing.
His having come here at all, a detour and a weakness.
His mind was freshly inclined toward sorrow, toward the fact that the world was full of sorrow, that everyone labored under some burden of sorrow, that all were suffering, that whatever way one took in this world, one must try to remember that all were suffering, none content, all wronged, neglected, overlooked, misunderstood. And therefore, one must do what one could to lighten the load of those with whom one came into contact. That his current state of sorrow was not uniquely his, not at all, but rather, its like had been felt, would yet be felt, by scores of others, in all times, in every time, and must not be prolonged or exaggerated, because in this state he could be of no help to anyone. And given that his position in the world situated him to be either of great help or great harm, it would not do to stay low, if he could help it.
All were in sorrow, or had been, or soon would be.
It was the nature of things.
Though on the surface it seemed every person was different, this was not true.
At the core of each lay suffering, our eventual end. The many losses we must experience on the way to that end.
We must try to see one another in this way.
As suffering, limited beings.
perennially outmatched by circumstance, inadequately endowed with compensatory graces.
His sympathy extended to all in this instant, blundering in its strict logic across all divides.
He was leaving here broken, awed, humbled, diminished.
Ready to believe anything of this world.
Made less rigidly himself through this loss.
Therefore quite powerful.
Reduced, ruined, remade.
Merciful, patient, dazzled.
And yet.
And yet, he was in a fight. Although those he fought were also suffering, limited beings, he must
obliterate them.
Kill them, and deny them their livelihood, and force them back into the fold.
He must, we felt, do all we could in light of the many soldiers lying dead and wounded in open fields all across the land, weeds violating their torsos, eyeballs pecked out or dissolving, lips hideously retracted, rain-soaked, blood-soaked, snow-crusted letters scattered about them, to ensure that we did not, as we trod that difficult path we were now well upon, blunder further. We had blundered so badly already. And, in so blundering, ruin more of these boys, each of whom was once dear to someone. Ruin more, we felt, must endeavor not to ruin more. Our grief must be defeated. It must not become our master and make us ineffective and put us even deeper into the ditch.
We must, to do the maximum good, bring the thing to its swiftest halt and
kill.
Kill more efficiently.
Hold nothing back.
Make the blood flow.
Bleed and bleed the enemy until his good sense be reborn.
The swiftest halt to the thing, therefore the greatest mercy, might be the bloodiest.
Must end suffering by causing more suffering.
We were low, lost, an object of ridicule, had almost nothing left, were failing. Must take some action to halt our fall, and restore ourselves to ourselves.
Must win the thing.
His heart dropped at the thought of the killing.
Did the thing merit it, merit the killing? On the surface, it was a technicality, mere union, but seen deeper, it was something more. How should men live? How could men live? Now he recalled the boy he had been, hiding from father to read Bunyan, raising rabbits to gain a few coins, standing in town as the gaunt daily parade drawled out the hard talk hunger made, having to reel back when one of those more fortunate passed merrily by in a carriage, feeling strange and odd, smart too, superior, long-legged, always knocking things over, called names, Ape Lincoln, Spider, Apeham, monstrous tall, but also thinking, quietly, there inside himself, that he might someday get something for himself. And then, going out to get it, he had found the way clear. His wit was quick. People liked him for his bumbling and his ferocity of purpose, and the peach orchards and haystacks and young girls and ancient wild meadows drove him nearly mad with their beauty, and strange animals moved in lazy mobs along muddy rivers, rivers crossable only with the aid of some old rowing hermit who spoke a language barely English. And all of it, all that bounty, was for everyone to use, seemingly put here to teach a man to be free. To teach that a man could be free, that any man, any free white man, could come from as low a place as he had. A rutting sound coming from the cane cabin. He had looked in through the open door and seen two pairs of still, socked feet and a baby toddling past, steadying herself by grasping one of the rudder's feet. And even a young fellow who had seen that and lived among those might rise here as high as he was inclined to go. And that, against this, the king types who would snatch the apple from your hand and claim to have grown it, even though what they had come to them intact, or been gained unfairly, the nature of that unfairness perhaps being just that they had been born stronger, more clever, more energetic than others, and who, having seized the apple, would eat it so proudly they seemed to think that not only had they grown it, but had invented the very idea of fruit, too. And the cost of this lie fell on the hearts of the low, Mr. Bellway rushing his children off their Sangamon porch as he and father slumped past with that heavy bag of grain drooping between them. Across the sea, fat kings watched and were gleeful that something begun so well had now gone off the rails, as down south similar kings watched. And if it went off the rails, so went the whole kit, forever. And if someone ever thought to start it up again, well, it would be said, and said truly, the rabble cannot manage itself. Well, the rabble could. The rabble would. He would lead the rabble in managing. The thing would be won.
Our Willie would not wish us hobbled in that attempt by a vain and useless grief.
In our mind, the lad stood atop a hill, merrily waving to us, urging us to be brave and resolve the thing.
But we stopped ourselves short. Was this not just wishful thinking? Weren't we, in order to enable ourselves to go on, positing from our boy a blessing we could not possibly verify? Yes. Yes, we were.
But we must do so and believe it, or else we were ruined.
And we must not be ruined.
But must go on.
We saw all of this in the instant it took Mr. Lincoln to pass through us.
And then he was out the door and into the night.
95.
We black folks had not gone into the church with the others. Our experience having been that white people are not especially fond of having us in their churches, unless it is to hold a baby, or prop up or hand fan some old one. Then here came that tall white man out the door right at me. I held my ground as he passed through, and got something along the lines of, I will go on. I will, with God's help. Though it seems killing must go hard against the will of God. Where might God stand on this? He has shown us he could stop it, but has not. We must see God not as a him, some linear rewarding fellow, but an it. A great beast beyond our understanding who wants something from us, and we must give it. And all we may control is the spirit in which we give it, and the ultimate end which the giving serves. What end does it wish served, I do not know. What it wants, it seems, for now, is blood, more blood, and to alter things from what they are to what it wills they should be. But what that new state is, I do not know, and patiently wait to learn, even as those 3,000 fallen stare foul-eyed at me, working dead hands anxiously, asking, what end might this thing yet attain? That will make our terrible sacrifice worthwhile. Then he was through me, and I was glad. Near the front gate stood Mr. Havens, square in that white man's path, as I had been, but doing then something I had not the nerve nor desire to do.
96.
I don't know what came over me. Never in that previous place had I been a rash person. What need had I to be? Mr. Connor and his good wife and all of their children and grandchildren were like family to me. Never was I separated from my own wife or children. We ate well, were never beaten. They had given us a small but attractive yellow cottage. It was a happy arrangement, all things considered. So I don't know what came over me. As that gentleman passed through, I felt a kinship and decided to stay a bit. Therein. So there we were, moving along together, me matching him step for step, which was not easy. His legs were long. I extended my legs to match his and extended all of myself. And we were the same size and out upon horseback. And forgive me, the thrill of once again riding a horse was too much, and I stayed. Therein, what a thrill it was to be doing what I wished, without having been ordered to do so, without having sought anyone's permission. The ceiling of a lifelong house flew off, if I may put it that way. I knew of the instant vast tracts of Indiana and Illinois, full towns and their complete layout and the nature of the hospitality of specific houses therein, though I had never been in either of those places, and came to feel that this fellow, well, my goodness, I will not say what office it seemed to me that he held. I began to feel afraid, occupying someone so accomplished, and yet I was comfortable in there, and suddenly wanted him to know me, my life, to know us, our lot. I don't know why I felt that way, but I did. He had no aversion to me, is how I might put it. Or rather, he had once had such an aversion, still bore traces of it. But in examining that aversion, pushing it into the light, had somewhat already eroded it. He was an open book. An opening book that had just been opened up somewhat wider by sorrow and by us, by all of us, black and white, who had so recently mass inhabited him. He had not, it seemed, gone unaffected by that event, not at all. It made him sad, sadder. We had, all of us, white and black, had made him sadder with our sadness. And now, though it sounds strange to say, he was making me sadder with his sadness. And I thought, well, sir, if we are going to make a sadness party of it, I have some sadness about which I think someone as powerful as you might like to know. And I thought then, as hard as I could, of Mrs. Hodge and Elson and Litzy, and of all I had heard during our long occupancy in that pit regarding their many troubles and degradations, and called to mind as well several others of our race I had known and loved. My mother, my wife, our children, Paul, Timothy, Gloria, Rance P., his sister B., the four little Cushmans, and all the things that they had endured. Thinking, sir, if you are as powerful as I feel that you are, and as inclined toward us as you seem to be, endeavor to do something for us so that we might do something for ourselves. We are ready, sir, are angry, are capable. Our hopes are coiled up so tight as to be deadly or holy. Turn us loose, sir. Let us at it. Let us show what we can do.
97.
Elson and Litzy had been by the chapel door, listening in. Now they trot skimmed over, holding hands. That little white boy, Litzy said. Said we are dead, said Elson.
Goodness, said Mrs. Hodge.
All these years in our pit, I had treasured up the notion that someday Annalise and Benjamin, my children, would what? Join me? Someday join me? Here? It was ludicrous. Suddenly I saw just how ludicrous. Poor me. Poor me, all of those years. They would never join me here. They would age and die and be laid to rest there in those far-flung locales to which they had been taken when taken from me. They would not come here. And anyway, why would I want that? I had wanted it somehow while I only waited, believing myself paused. But now that I knew I was dead, I wanted for them only to go to where they should, directly there, wherever that was. And feeling that way, saw that I ought to go there myself. I looked at Litzy in our old way, as if to say, "Lady, what do you think?" "I'll do what you do, Mrs. Hodge," Litzy said. "You always been like a mother to me."
Sad, though. I'd only just got my voice back, and now it was time to leave.
"Elson," I said. "No," he said. "If such things as goodness and brotherhood and redemption exist and may be attained, these must sometimes require blood, vengeance, the squirming terror of the former perpetrator, the vanquishing of the heartless oppressor. I intend to stay here until I've had my revenge upon someone." Such a dear boy, so proud, so dramatic. "We are dead," I said. "Here I am," he said. "I am here." I said no more, for if he wished to stay, I would not impede him. We all must do what we like. "Ready," I said to Litzy. As if for old time's sake, she gave me the double-eyed blink, which had always meant, yes.
Dear brother, a postscript. After writing the above, went to bed. Sometime later woke to sound of horses' hooves. I summoned Grace, and she helped me into the wheeled chair and to the window. And who should be leaving but Mr. L. himself, I swear it, looking ever so weary and stooped in the saddle as he rode away. I opened the window and shouted down to good old Manders to confirm. It was indeed the president. What must be the extent of his heartache for him to have come here at this cold and cruel hour of the night? Now I must have Grace help me back to bed. I'm doing my best to summon her only when necessary, as she has been out of sorts with me lately, always in a bad temper and never jolly with me anymore, as if sick of me, and who could blame her? It is not happy to be at the beck and call of one so immobilized. And I cannot blame her, for I recently am having more pain, and my good spirits often compromised. But she is no friend. Of this I must constantly remind myself. She is hired by us to care for me, and that is all. Brother, when do you come home? I know you wander for your own purposes, but find it hard to believe you are not lonely. Or perhaps you have charmed some prairie lady. Your sister is tired and lonely and sick. Do you not love me? Do you not wish to see me again? Please come home. I do not wish to alarm you. Do not say these things to force you home, but feel so poorly lately. Weak and drifting in mind and unable to eat. Is it not right that we who love one another should be together? Please come home. I miss you so, and have no real friend here in this place. Your loving sister, Isabel.
99.
As Prez emerged from chapel, I hightailed it out of guardhouse to unlock gate. Prez went out saying nothing, seeming distracted, reached over, gave my forearm warm squeeze, then hopped upon the back of his little horse, and I thought whole caboodle might go over on its side, but No, that little horse hero, stealing himself, clopped away, quite dignified, as if he meant to protect Prez's reputation by acting as if Prez's feet were not nearly scraping the ground. And I tell you, Tom, that noble nag might have been bearing Hercules or G. Washington for all the pride in his step as they disappeared down our street into chilly night. As I was locking back up, Tom had feeling of being watched, and looked up and saw that our mystery girl from across the street sat her faithful post at her window, and lifting said window from her sitting position with considerable effort, called across to me, "Was that Prez who just rode off?" And I called back, "Yes, indeed." And it was sad, Tom, as I have known her or seen her at least since she was a little girl, who could still walk and run with all the others. Now she must be nearly 30, and feeling kindly inclined toward her now, I called up that she'd best shut the window for the cold, for I'd heard she was not well, and she thanked me for my concern and said it was a sad thing, wasn't it, about Prez's son. And I said, oh, very sad, indeed. She said she thought the child must surely be in a better place. And I said I hoped so and prayed so. And our voices hung there as if we were last living souls on earth. And good night, said I. Good night, said she. And brought her window down, and soon enough, her light went out.
100.
A mass exodus from the chapel ensued, our cohort fleeing out through all four walls at once.
Many succumbing, even while in motion.
Mr. Bevins and I rushed out together, as the inky night around the chapel lit up with multiple instances of the matter-light-blooming phenomenon.
All was chaos.
The pale smock of the beautiful raped mulatto floated down, still stained with bloody handprints at the hips,
followed by the large, unoccupied dress of Mrs. Hodge.
The air was filled with curses, shouts, the hissing velocity sounds of our dear friends desperately rushing away through bushes and low-hanging trees.
Several had been so severely infected with doubt that locomotion now became impossible.
These slumped wearily against stones, crawled weakly along pathways, lay draped and broken-seeming across benches, as if dropped from the sky.
Many succumbing from these undignified positions.
Now, across the chapel lawn, charged Lieutenant Stone,
heading directly for Mr. Farwell.
Clear thee away! Cease contaminating this holy place, Shard! As I'm the man among all here who's been in this place the longest, the number of my nights here being beyond 20,000, and the number of souls who come into this place have, through cowardice and flinching, since departed anon by my latest count nearing 900. Who shall manage things here if not me? And I will be damned, and damned good, if the current chaos shall be exploited by a Shard man as an excuse to loaf.
Even the lieutenant's extreme self-confidence seemed affected by the recent confusion, for he did not grow any taller during this diatribe and seemed even to shrink a little.
The lieutenant ordered Mr. Farwell back to work, back to whatever work had been assigned him by whichever white person had assigned it, at which time Mr. Farwell seized the lieutenant by the collar and threw him roughly down upon his back.
The lieutenant demanded to know how Mr. Farwell dared touch a white man in anger, and commanded Farwell to let him up. Mr. Farwell refusing, the lieutenant kicked Farwell in the chest, and Farwell flew back. And the lieutenant leapt to his feet, and straddling Farwell, began beating him about the head with his fists. In desperation, Farwell groped about for a nearby pathstone and swung it into the lieutenant's head, causing the lieutenant to fall to the ground and his tricorn to fly off. Farwell then positioned one knee upon the lieutenant's chest and used the stone to smash the lieutenant's skull into a flat, pulpy mass, after which he stumbled away and sat on the ground disconsolately, head in hands, weeping.
The lieutenant's head quickly reforming, he revived and, catching sight of the weeping Mr. Farwell, barked out that he was not aware a Shard could weep, since to weep one must possess human emotions, and again ordered Mr. Farwell back to work, back to whatever work had been assigned him by whichever white person had assigned it, and again Mr. Farwell seized the lieutenant by the collar and threw him down upon his back, and again the lieutenant demanded to know how Mr. Farwell dare touch a white man in anger, and commanded Farwell to let him up. And Mr. Farwell again refusing, the lieutenant again kicked Farwell in the chest.
And so on.
It was still going on as we fled the scene.
Showed no signs of abating.
Was proceeding with a fury that suggested the two might well fight on into eternity.
Unless some fundamental and unimaginable alteration of reality should occur.
101.
Mr. Vollman and I ran skimmed desperately toward our home places.
Shaken.
Even we were shaken.
Even Mr. Bevins and I were shaken.
Brother, what are we to do? I called over. Here we are, Mr. Vollman called back. Look at me. Here I am. Who is it? Who is it that speaks? Who is it hears my speaking? But we were shaken.
We came now upon the disreputable barons, collapsed in a heap atop the Constantine sick mound, an unremarkable limestone slab, cracked at one corner, marred by bird droppings over many decades.
For someone long ago had planted a small tree overhead to shade Constantine from the sun.
Get up! Get up! No fucking stopping! No fucking thinking!
I ain't! I ain't fucking thinking! I just don't feel good.
Look at me. Look at me. Remember that time we lived in that fucking beautiful field? With the kids? That, spacious meadow? In that tent? Remember that? After fucking Donovan evicted us from that shithole by the river? Those were the days, huh?
That was no fucking spacious meadow, you piece of shit. That was where all the fucking scum of the earth came to shit and dropped their goddamn garbage.
But what a view, huh? Not many kids get that view. We could look out our tent flap, and right there, the fucking White House.
But first, you had to walk around the goddamn trash heap while watching out for those big fucking rats and that gang of Hessian gropers that fucking lived in there.
They never groped you, though.
Bullshit! I had to burn one fucker's leg with a shovel full of hot coals to get him off me. Came right in the fucking tent, in front of the fucking kids. No wonder they never come see us. We've been here. How long we been here? A pretty fucking long time, and they never come once.
Fuck them, right? Those fucking ingrate snakes have no goddamn right to blame us for a fucking thing until they walk a fucking mile in our goddamn shoes, and neither fucking one of the little shitheads ever walked even a...
Eddie, no. They was our kids. We fucked it up.
No fucking sad shit, and no fucking stopping. No fucking thinking. You know why? We want to fucking stay. Got plenty of celebrating left to fucking do, right?
Eddie. We're fucking dead, Eddie. Love you. You fucking fucker.
No. No, 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 don't. Don't do it. Stay the fuck with me, kid.
Her flesh became thin as parchment. Tremors ran through her body. Her form flickered between the various selves she had been in that previous place, too debauched and impoverished and shameful to mention, and then between the various future forms she had, alas, never succeeded in attaining, attentive mother, mindful baker of bread and cakes, sober church attender, respected, soft-spoken grandmother surrounded by her adoring, clean brood.
Then came the familiar, yet always bone-chilling, fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon.
And she was gone.
Her threadbare and malodorous clothing raining down all around.
Mr. Barron let loose a prodigious howl of obscenities and succumbed, albeit reluctantly, compelled by his inordinate affection for that lady, the color of his matter-light-blooming phenomenon, not the usual luminous white, but rather a dingy gray.
Smelling of tobacco, sweat, and whiskey, his clothes came raining down.
And a racing form, and an obscene cartoon.
102.
Suddenly, Mr. Bevins did not look well. His flesh was thin as parchment. Tremors ran through his body.
So many memories were flooding back. I recalled a certain morning, I had seen Gilbert at the baker's. Yes, yes, I had, my God. He was, most painful. He was with someone, a man, dark-haired, tall, broad-chested. Gilbert whispered something to him, and they shared a laugh, at my expense, it seemed. The world went flat. It seemed a stage set built for the telling of a specific joke to be told on me. Having been born with my propensity, I would find Gilbert, come to love him, but would not be able to be with him, for he wished to live correctly. And then the punchline, me, crestfallen in that baker's doorway, loaf in hand, the two of them approaching, pausing, the whisper, the laugh. And they broke around on either side of me, this new fellow, he was so beautiful, raising an eyebrow as if to say, that? That is him? Then another killing laugh burst. I rushed home and proceeded.
Mr. Bevins dropped to his knees. His form flickered between the various selves he had been in that previous place. An effeminate but affectionate young boy, much fussed over by a family of sisters. A diligent student, crouched over multiplication tables. A naked young man in a carriage house, reaching over to tenderly kiss that Gilbert. A good son, posed between his parents for a daguerreotype on the occasion of his birthday. A red-faced, distraught disaster, tears rolling down his face, butcher knife in hand, porcelain tub in his lap. "Do you remember," he said, "when I first came here, you were so kind to me, calmed me down, convinced me to stay. Do you remember?" "I was happy to be of service," I said. "I just remembered something else," he said, in a tone of wonder. "Your wife once came to visit."
"I do not recall any such occurrence," Mr. Volman replied stiffly. "My wife, believing my recovery best aided by a period of solitude, prefers not to visit." "Friend," I said, "enough. Let us speak honestly. I am remembering many things, and I suspect that you are too." "Not at all," Mr. Volman said. "A plump, beaming woman came here," I said, "a year or so ago, and recounted many things. Happy things concerning her life, her numerous children, her excellent husband, and thanked you, imagine, for your early kindness to her, which had, as she put it, allowed me to deliver myself unsullied to he who would prove to be the great love of my life. She thanked you for placing her on the path to love, and for never, never once being unkind to her, but always gentle and dear and considerate. A true friend, she called you." Tears were rolling down Mr. Volman's face. "She did you the honor, sir, of coming to say goodbye, and standing at your grave, explained that she would not, in future, be able to join you there, as she must instead, eventually, lie beside this new fellow, her husband, who was..." "Please," Mr. Volman said. "Who was much younger," I said, "than you. Closer, that is, to her own age." "You," Mr. Volman said abruptly, "you cut your wrists and bled to death on your kitchen floor." "Yes," I said, "yes, I did." "Many years ago," he said. "So many years ago," I said. "Oh, God," Mr. Volman said, and his flesh grew thin as parchment, and tremors ran through his body, and his form began to flicker between the various selves he had been in that previous place, fresh-faced apprentice in an ink-stained smock. Young widower wiping away tears for his first wife, fingernails blue-rimmed with his work despite an obsessive pre-funeral scrubbing. lonely, middle-aged fellow with no hopes at all, who only worked and drank and, in a depressed state, occasionally whored. A heavy-set, limping, wooden-toothed 46-year-old printer glimpsing from across the parlor at the wickets upon New Year's Day, a radiant young woman in a lime dress, little more than a girl, really. And in that moment, he felt himself no longer old, but young, interesting, vital, dashing, and for the first time in years, felt he had something to offer, and someone to whom he hoped he might be allowed to offer it.
"Shall we?"
Mr. Bevan said.
"Shall we go together?"
And assumed his various future forms. Forms he had never, alas, succeeded in attaining. A fine-looking young man on the prow of a ship, gazing off at a row of yellow and blue houses, just coming into view upon a distant shoreline. And on that voyage he had been fucked, and fucked well, by a Brazilian engineer who had taught him much and given him much pleasure. And now Mr. Bevins knew that that life was for him, whether it be good or not in God's eyes. The contented lover, for many years now, of a gentle, bearded pharmacist named Reardon. A prosperous, chubby, middle-aged fellow, nursing poor Reardon through his final illness. An old geezer of nearly 100, blessedly free of all desire for man, food, breath, being driven to church in some sort of miracle vehicle, before which stood no horse, and which went about on rubber wheels, loud as some perpetually firing cannon.
"Yes, all right," Mr. Woolman said. "Let us go. Together."
And it seemed we had passed the point of choosing. The knowledge of what we were was strong within us now, and would not be denied.
And yet something held us back.
We knew what.
Who?
Of one mind now, we flu-skimmed east, erratically caroming off boulders and hillocks and the walls of stone homes, like wounded birds, feeling nothing but urgency to reach our destination. Flickering on and off, weak and growing weaker, sustained barely by some lingering, dissipating belief in our own reality. East and east and east, until we reached the edge of that uninhabited wilderness of some several hundred yards.
That ended in the dreaded iron fence.
103.
The trainer girl lay as usual, trapped against and part of the fence, manifesting at that moment as a scaled-down, smoking wreck of a rail car. Several dozen charred and expiring individuals trapped within her, barking out the most obscene demands, as Miss Trainor's wheels turned mercilessly upon several hogs, who, we were given to understand, had caused the crash, and possessed human faces and voices, and were crying out most piteously, as the wheels turned and turned and crushed and re-crushed them, giving off the smell of burning pork.
We had come to apologize.
For our cowardice, at the time of her initial doom.
Which had always, in every minute since, gnawed at us.
Our first huge failing.
Our initial abandonment of the better nature we had brought with us from that previous place.
Standing outside the burning car, I called in. "Can you hear me, dear?" I shouted. "There is something we wish to say."
The train shifted a bit on its tracks and flames leapt up, and several of the hogs who had caused the crash turned to us, and, in a beautiful American dialect that came out of their perfectly formed human faces, told us in no uncertain terms that she could not and would not be saved, and hated it all and hated us all, and if we did indeed care for her, why not leave her alone, for our presence aggravated her already considerable torment, reminding her, as it did, of the hopes she had held in that previous place and of who she had been upon first arriving here.
A spinning young girl.
In a summer frock of continually shifting color.
We are sorry, I shouted in. Sorry that we did not do more to convince you to go, back when you still had the chance. We were afraid, Mr. Bevan said. Afraid for ourselves. Anxious, I said. Anxious that we might fail in our endeavor. We felt we must conserve our resources, Mr. Bevan said. We are sorry this happened to you, I said. You did not deserve it, Mr. Bevan said. And sorry especially that we did not stay to console you as you went down, I said. You did rather slink away, said one of the hogs.
Mr. Volman's face contorted with the memory. Then something changed, and he looked strong and vital, like the man he must have been in his shop, a man who would not have slunk away from much of anything at all, and sped through his various future forms, a beaming fellow in a disordered bed, the morning after he and Anna would have consummated their marriage, she gleefully threw her head upon his chest and reached between his legs, eager to begin again. A father of twin girls who looked like paler, smaller Annas. A retired printer with bad knees, helped along a boardwalk by that same Anna, older now herself, but still beautiful. And as they went along, they spoke confidentially back and forth, somewhat habitually, not always agreeing, in a code that seemed to have developed between them about the twins, now mothers themselves. Mr. Volman turned to me, smiling in a pained but kindly way. None of that ever was, he said, and it never will be. Then he drew a deep breath and stepped into the burning train.
I could see Miss Traynor there, in what had been the dining car, her face clearly visible within the striped lavender wallpaper.
Young Mr. Bristol desired me. Young Mr. Fellows and Mr. Delway desired me. Of an evening they would sit on the grass around me, and in their eyes burned the fiercest, kindest desire. It was all very... Then Mother would send Annie to come, and I wanted so much to hold a dear babe. You might, sir, you might, sire, do me a service, a great service. I know very well I do not look as pretty as I once... You might try, might at least try, do it here, do it now, won't you? Blow this fuck-cock-ass-ravaged train up, sir, with your going. If you please, it might free me. Don't know, can't say for sure, but have been so unhappy here so long.
I will try, I said.
From within the train came the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound of the matter-light blooming phenomenon. The train began to vibrate, the hogs to squeal. I threw myself down on the good and blessed earth, soon to be mine no more. The train exploded. Seats rained down, hog parts rained down, menus rained down, luggage, newspapers, umbrellas, ladies' hats, men's shoes, cheap novels rained down. Rising to my knees, I saw that where the train had been was now only the dreaded iron fence. And there was nothing left for me to do but go, though the things of the world were strong with me still. Such as, for example, a gaggle of children trudging through a side-blown December flurry, a friendly match share beneath some collision-tilted streetlight, a frozen clock bird-visited within its high tower, cold water from a tin jug, toweling off one's clinging shirt post-June rain. Pearls, rags, buttons, rug tuft, beer froth. Someone's kind wishes for you, someone remembering to write, someone noticing that you are not at all at ease. A bloody roast, death red on a platter. a hedge top underhand as you flee late to some chalk and wood-fire-smelling schoolhouse. Geese above, clover below, the sound of one's own breath when winded. The way a moistness in the eye will blur a field of stars. The sore place on the shoulder a resting toboggan makes. Writing one's beloved's name upon a frosted window with a gloved finger. Tying a shoe, tying a knot on a package. A mouth on yours. A hand on yours. The ending of the day. The beginning of the day. The feeling that there will always be a day ahead. Goodbye. I must now say goodbye to all of it. Loon call in the dark. Calf cramp in the spring. Neck rub in the parlor. Milk sip at end of day. Some bandy-legged dog proudly backplows the grass to cover its modest shit. A cloud mass down valley breaks apart over the course of a brandy-deepened hour. Louvered blinds yield dusty beneath your dragging finger, and it is nearly noon, and you must decide. You have seen what you have seen, and it has wounded you, and it seems you have only one choice left. Blood-stained porcelain bowl wobbles face down on wood floor, orange peel not at all stirred by disbelieving last breath there amongst that fine summer dust layer. Fatal knife set down in passing panic on familiar wobbly banister, later dropped, thrown by mother, dear mother, heartsick into the slow-flowing chocolate-brown Potomac. None of it was real. Nothing was real. Everything was real, inconceivably real, infinitely dear. These and all things started as nothing, latent within a vast energy broth. But then we named them and loved them, and in this way brought them forth. And now must lose them. I send this out to you, dear friends, before I go, in this instantaneous thought burst from a place where time slows and then stops, and we may live forever in a single instant. Goodbye. Goodbye, good.
104.
Caroline and Matthew and Richard and I lay entangled there in our spot near the flagpole. My part to Caroline's mouth, her rear to Richard's part, Matthew's part to my rear, Caroline's part being shared by Matthew's mouth and my extended stroking middle finger.
Mr. Leonard Reedy.
Seems we'd missed the big excitement.
Mrs. Caroline Reedy.
Having been engaged in some excitement of our own.
Richard Crutcher.
But then, the noise of the many matter-light-blooming phenomena growing annoying...
We men became flaccid.
Making further excitement problematic.
Me and Richard and Mr. Reedy hacked up our pants, and Mrs. Reedy redid her skirt and blouse, and we rushed over along the fence line toward that other, lesser excitement.
Matthew Crutcher.
En route, we glimpsed Mr. Bevins.
Damn Nance.
On his knees by the fence, mumbling to himself.
Then the usual big to-do. Flash of light, clothes raining down.
No more Bevins.
105.
The sun was nearly up. Those of us who had survived that ghastly night huddled, conferred, went on brief sprinting expeditions, searching for survivors. We did not find Purdy, nor Johannes, nor Crawley. Did not find Pickler, Ella Blow, Verna Blow, Appleton, Scarry, Thorne. Midden was missing, as were Goncourt, Cup, Edwell, and Longstreet. Reverend Thomas, missing. Even Bevins and Volman, two of our most long-standing and faithful residents, gone. How we pitied these, so gullible, broken by the rantings of a mere boy, lost forever. Sweet fools.
Here we were, Were we not? If not, who spoke?
Who heard?
What a slaughter. And we'd only managed to survey a tiny fraction of the premises.
Soon day began to break in earnest, and here came the usual all-body weakness and the accompanying sense of diminishment, and we dashed off for our respective home places and situated ourselves squeamishly within our sick forms, eyes closed or averted, so as not to see what those foul things had become.
And as the sun came up, we prayed, each within ourselves, our usual prayer.
To still be here when the sun next set.
Mrs. Antoinette Boxer.
And discover, in those first moments of restored movement, that we had again been granted the great mother gift.
Time.
More time.
106.
As always, at sun's rising, the two realms merged, and all that was true in ours became true in theirs. All the stones, trees, shrubs, hills, valleys, streams, pondlets, marshes, patches of light and shade merged, and were the same betwixt the two environs. And you could not have told one realm from the other. Much that was new and strange and unnerving had occurred this night. We three bachelors had watched it all unfold from on high, safe, separate, and free, the way we liked it. I enjoined my young charges that we must now beat a hasty retreat to our sick boxes and get ourselves within that which awaited us there.
Faugh. We did not like entering those things.
At all.
But that was the price. We must abide, fully awake but inert, within those foul things that had once resembled, had once been, us, and which we had loved so dearly, until such time as night again fell. At which time, shooting forth, we would be...
Free.
Free again.
Ourselves, truly.
All of blessed creation restored to us.
Everything again possible.
We three had never wed, nor truly loved. But once night fell again, and if we found ourselves still resident here, might strike the never.
For until we are ended, never may not be truly said.
And love may yet be ours.
107.
Just now took lantern out to Carol Crypt, Tom, to make sure all was well, and found young Lincoln's coffin slightly jutting out of the wall slot, and pushed it back in. Oh, that poor little fellow. Concluding his first ever lonely night here of many such lonely nights to come. A long, sad eternity of such nights. Could not help but think of our Philip, about same age as Prez's boy, who'll be racing about the yard and come in, just positively lit up from inside with joy of living, having been flirting over fence with a Mrs. Amy and Reba Leonard next door, his hair tousled, and grab a broom and in his overflow of happy spirits goose Mrs. Alberts the cook in her hindquarters, but when she turns to give him a wallop back holding a tremendous turnip and sees that glowing face, what can she do but drop said turnip into wash basin and grabbing him about neck smother him with kisses while I secretly hand her broom so as he scats away victorious she can give him a sort of avenging goose of her own, in his familiar play-worn trousers, and a good poke, too, as that lady's arms are like pot roasts. Oh, Lord, I cannot bear the thought of Philip lying still in such a place as this. And when that thought arises, must hum some scrap of tune energetically while praying, no, 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 take that cup away, Lord, let me go first before any of them I love, before Philip, Mary, Jack Jr., before dear Lydia. Only that's no good either, since when they reach their end, I will not be there to help them. Oh, either way, it is too unbearable. Oh, God, what a bind one is in down here, Tom. Dear friend Tom, I long for sleep. I await your arrival and hope these sad and morbid thoughts will soon fade away soon with the happy sight of our dear friend rising, the sun.
108.
I rode along in that gentleman upon our little horse. Through those quiet streets, and I was not unhappy. Though he was. He had neglected his wife by this night's indulgence, he felt. And they had another little sick boy at home, who might also succumb. Though he was better today, he might yet succumb. Anything could happen. As he now knew, he had forgotten. He had somewhat forgotten about the other boy. Tad. Dear little Tad. The gentleman had much on his mind. He did not wish to live. Not really. It was just now too hard. There was so much to do. He was not doing it well, and if done poorly, all would go to ruin. Perhaps in time, he told himself, it would get better and might even be good again. He did not really believe it. It was hard. Hard for him. Hard for me to be in there. I resolved, nevertheless, to stay. It was getting on near morning. Normally during the day we took our rest, were drawn back to our shells and must rest in there. Tonight, I did not feel that draw. But I was sleepy. I dozed and slipped through him into his horse, who was, I felt at that moment, pure patience, head to hoof, and fond of the man. Never before had I felt oats to be such a positive thing in the world, or so craved a certain blue blanket. And then I roused myself and sat up straight and fully rejoined the gentleman. And we rode forward into the night, past the sleeping houses of our countrymen.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, featuring, in order of their appearance, Nick Offerman as Hans Vollmann, David Sedaris as Roger Bevins III, Carrie Brownstein as Isabel Perkins, George Saunders as the Reverend Everly Thomas, Miranda July as Mrs. Elizabeth Crawford, Lena Dunham as Elise Traynor, Ben Stiller as Jack Manders, Julianne Moore as Jane Ellis, Susan Sarandon as Mrs. Abigail Blass, Bradley Whitford as Lieutenant Cecil Stone, Bill Hader as Eddie Barron, Megan Mullally as Betsy Barron, Rain Wilson as Percival Dash Collier, Jeff Tweedy as Captain William Prince, Kat Dennings as Miss Tamara Doolittle, Jeffrey Tambor as Professor Edmund Bloomer, Mike O'Brien as Lawrence T. DeCroy, Keegan Michael Key as Elson Farwell, Don Cheadle as Thomas Havens, and Patrick Wilson as Stanley Professor Lippert, with Kirby Hayborn as Willie Lincoln, Mary Carr as Mrs. Rose Milland, and Cassandra Campbell as your narrator. Additional voices by Max Adler, McLeod Andrews, Sean Baker, Avita Basharod, Amanda Beasley, Patrick Billard, Jane Billings, Aaron Blank, Paul Bamer, Mark Bramhall, Hugo Bresson, Scott Brick, Nancy Bruns, Danny Campbell, Matt Cartsonis, Mark Cashman, Mike Chamberlain, Jeff Cohen, Michael Crouch, Amanda DiCerno, Phil David, Mark Deakins, Robertson Dean, Charles de Montebello, Benjamin Dreyer, Noah Eaker, Justine Eyre, Kimberly Farr, Liz Farrell, Dr. Andrew Fiedler, Barbara Fillon, Ed Franco, Brad Garrett, Michael Gentile, Ryan Gazelle, Kelly Gilday, Michael Goldsmith, Russ Gorsline, Ben Greenberg, Kaleo Griffith, Christopher Grove, Cesar Guadamuse, Robert Guzman, David Hawsey, Grant Heyer, Dominic Hoffman, J.T. Holcomb, Maggie Holcomb, Mark Holcomb, Sarah Holcomb, Tyler Holcomb, Lincoln Hoppe, Stephen Hoy, Tony Huds, Andy Hughes, Arthur G. Insana, Gildart Jackson, Lane Jansen, Susan Camel, Mika Kasuga, Simon Katz, Jeff Kenyon, Scott Kolwitz, Greg Cuby, Anne-Marie Lee, John Lee, Joe Lindblom, Sherry Lindblom, Adam Lissagor, Eric Lovis, Rebecca Lohman, Colonel Kevin Madden, Bruce Mann, Lee Marchant, Eric Martin, John H. Mayer, Jonathan McLean, Catherine McEwen, Caitlin McKenna, David McLaughlin, Stephen Mendel, Peter Mendelson, Robin Miles, Arthur Morey, Oliver Mundy, Mike Murray, Dan Musselman, Mike Musselman, Kayla Myers, Esther Newberg, Samuel Nicholson, Adenrale Ojo, Pat Pacino, Dara Parikh, Thomas Perry, David Fethian, Ray Porter, Louise Quayle, Bob Quinto, Lorna Raver, Hilary Redman, Holiday Reinhorn, Jared Robbins, Brent Rogers, Richard Romaniello, Bill Rude, Michael Rotondo, Jennifer Rubens, Tom Russell, Fred Sanders, Elena Saunders, Caitlin Saunders, George Saunders Sr., Joan Saunders, Paula Saunders, Joe Scalora, Robin Schiff, Heather Scott, Ted Scott, Rob Shapiro, Phil Stamper Halpin, Pat Stango, Simon Tipaz, Kevin Thompson, Deborah Treisman, Bonnie Turpin, Molly Turpin, Sam Tweedy, Spencer Tweedy, Elena Wagner, Bob Walter, Andy Ward, Ben Waters, Jeff Weber, Nikki Weinstock, David Weller, Julia Whalen, Tyler Whitlatch, Henry Williams, Greg Wilson, Dan Warren, Richard Wild, and Dan Zitt. For more extensive information, including a full list of characters, please visit www.penguinrandomhouseaudio.com/Lincoln in the Bardo. This program was directed by Kelly Gilday and produced by Kelly Gilday and George Saunders. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Ted and Heather Scott of 50 Nugget Wash Productions. Tamale Never Knows, written and recorded by Jeff Tweedy, courtesy of DBPM Records. Text copyright 2017 by George Saunders. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.